Jeff Brown of China Rising, that puntopress.com, is with us today on the podcast. It's good to have you here, Jeff.
Thank you. Welcome. Greetings from Beijing, China.
Greetings from Mexico. Jeff is a geopolitical analyst with a focus on all things China. He has written 44 Days, Reflections in Sinoland, Musings and Anecdotes from the Belly of the New Century of Beast. And his new book we'll be talking about is China Rising, Capitalist Roads, The True Face of Asia's Enigmatic Colossus, among other publications. Now, people can check out the biography on your website, which is extensive, but you were born and raised in America. You joined the Peace Corps, like myself, and then you took off.
All right.
Yeah, I was in Mongolia. You were in Tunisia, I think, right?
Yeah, no, an RPCV. We're brothers.
Yeah. And then afterwards, you went to numerous countries. You learned numerous languages, a bit like myself as well. And in 2010, you went back to China. So could you tell us what was it or what is it about China that attracts you?
This is a 5,000-year-old civilization. It's not even a culture. It's a civilization. And, you know, we can talk about Western civilization and Chinese civilization. And China's is the longest continuing existing civilization. It has an amazing history. And I feel like, you know, I grew up in the United States, and as I, you know, wrote about in my introduction and China Rising, you know, I grew up in the late 50s, early 60s, you know, with, the atomic bomb, you know, a threat from the Soviets and the Red Chinese and the Red Commies and the Red Russians and, you know, and patriotism and all that. And I realize I was extremely brainwashed. But I wanted to, you know, in moving back here, I really wanted to, for the first time in my life, look at the world and look at the perspective of world history through the eyes of the Chinese people. And that's what I've been trying to do since 2010 with my writings and interviews and books, et cetera.
And you mentioned in your the prologue, which is available on your website, China Rising, I want to quote, you say, "I now understand that getting de-brainwashed takes a lot of effort, humility, and personal courage. I get inspired reading about other people's journeys to discover the truth." You know, I feel the same way, and I think I went through some of what you did. Can you tell us a little bit about the brainwashing you had to extricate yourself from?
The first problem is that Westerners are completely, I would say, well, 99% of them are completely oblivious to the fact that they are brainwashed. They, mm-hmm. you know, I call it the Great Western Firewall, as a spinoff of the, you know, Great Firewall of China. You know, people talk about the Great Firewall of China and how we have no freedom over here and all this other bunk. And so I spun that off and called it the Great Western Firewall. And when I go, and I love my family, I love my friends, and when I go back to the United States, but they really live in a bubble. They are completely isolated and completely manipulated by, you know, Edward Bernays, style propaganda. And Neil Postman wrote a great book, you know, Amused to Death, or, you know, Amused to Being Amused to Death. And, or he talked about, you know, people talk about, you know, China, you know, having Orwellian control. He was saying that in the West, you know, we are under Huxleyan, you know, Aldous Huxley, a Brave New World kind of control. And so in the United States, it is all done through, you know, the commercial, you know, commercials and you know, TV, radio, you know, entertainment. It's very, very highly manipulated, very highly controlled, very highly followed and tracked and massaged and pushed by, you know, the powers that be. Whereas over here, you know, we know that the control of the press and the media is the, you know, the Communist Party of China. And when I talk to Chinese, they know, you know, they know that their press is under the control of the Communist Party. But if you go to, you know, if I talk to my loved ones in the United States and friends, they don't know that their press is being manipulated. They think they have a, quote, free press, and it's not. It's, the press in the United States, the television, the radio, the print media is infested with CIA type non-official covers, even paid journalists. This is all now out in the open, and so that's the big problem. And I had to get over that. I mean, even when I got here in 2010. You know, I still thought that the New York Times and The Economist, you know, were cutting edge journalism. Now I realize, after being over here and really starting to study it, now I realize, you know, that the Economist and the New York Times and the BBC and PBS, I mean, they're no different than CCTV the People's Daily or any other media here in China. It's all the same. It's just how and who is doing the control. Here it's directly government, and in the United States it's the banks, the CIA, the National Security, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who are doing it through commercialism.
And that's one of the things that fascinates me the most. As you say, in China, the people are aware. Here in Mexico, where I am as well, people are, aware of what the Mexican government does. And even with my own family and other Americans, the thing that fascinates me the most is this psychological grip that the U.S. Government and media have on Americans. And I just can't believe, how they just don't get it, even when you put the evidence right in front of their face.
Absolutely. Yeah, I try. I mean, hopefully people will be tempted to read China Rising. It's going to upset a lot of people, because it's about two-thirds of the book is about China. Mm-hmm. Chinese history, Chinese politics, Chinese, the Communist Party, pre 49, the century of humiliation with colonialism and imperialism over here, and then the Mao era, the Deng era, and now what I call the Xi era. But about a third of the book is about the West, looking at the West through the eyes of the Chinese. And the long and the short of it is that when you scratch below the surface, they don't like us, and they have every right not to like us, because all they see, is 500 years of brutal colonial imperial exploitation. And they were the direct victim of that from 1839 to 1949, with the Opium Wars and all the Europeans and the Japanese, camped out here until Mao Zedong liberated the country. So I did try to include that in the book, that's what got me. What pulled the scales off of my eyes was my willingness to put down my defenses and say, what do the Chinese really think about us? How do they really see us, as a civilization? And it's not pretty, and it is very, very, very ugly, and quite frankly, psychopathic. And I've done lots of research on genocide and exterminations, and the Chinese, the Western press, Mao Zedong during the Great Leap Forward, killed 30, 40 million people. Well, he didn't kill them. There was a horrific drought while they were trying to collectivize. But even the Chinese admit that 17 million people, I take an average of 25. They're anywhere from 17 to 40 million. So I take an average of 25. At the time it was, 4% of the population. Well, I can go back and I've done all kinds of research. The British, Darunpal, the great, Indian, historian, estimates that the British over 300 years, killed between, you know, 1 billion and 1.5 billion people Southeast Asia, in Southern Asia and Southeast Asia, you know, the great, you know, the crown jewel. The French, you know, exterminated 9% of the Vietnamese population with an enforced famine. This was in the 1940s. Now, the British were killed millions of people, 8 or 9 million people in Bengal, up into the 1940s with a forced famine. The British, you know, slaughtered a couple of million Irish. You know, the potato famine was not an accident. It was a legislated genocide to exterminate the Irish. This was done by the British. So whatever the Chinese or the Russians have done, that first off, if they did anything, they did it to themselves, and they didn't do it to other people, but to other races. Mm-hmm. And it is an absolute infinitesimal speck in proportion to the heinous crimes that the West has perpetrated. You know, wildly apologist of Western empire cannot get the number of Native Americans below 50 million when the Spanish arrived, you know, in 1492, the Portuguese Spanish. And you know, Howard Zinnist, you know, his research said 75 million. There's a couple of guys, in fact, one from the University of Oklahoma Press, a couple of eminent researchers in the United States said it was probably closer to 100 million Native Americans. 90%, you know, the West wiped out 90% of those people. Mm-hmm. You know, wiped out, just literally exterminated the Native American civilizations. So whatever the West criticizes China, you know, the Taiping Rebellion or the Great Leap Forward or the Cultural Revolution. First off, that was done in country, in house, with their own people, not with other people, not against other people. And it's absolutely, and even Stalin, you know, with what he did back in the 30s, is just absolutely insignificant compared to what the West has done to other people all across the planet on every inhabited continent.
And I think that's just the nature of any empire, because if we look back in history, you have to be objective. You know, thousands of years ago, China was a great empire, and then, you know, you have Rome and European empires, the British, and then the America rises. And before we talk about China rising, you mentioned a bit, I want to look at what key points would you focus on looking at the decline of the American empire?
I read a couple of great books, Jared Diamond's The Collapse. I mentioned it in 44 Days. And then I read The Collapse of Complex Societies. Right now, his name escapes me. The Joseph Tainter.
Yeah, Joseph
Tainter. Yeah, I read that. And I read The Collapse by Jared Diamond. And for whatever reason, the civilizations, you know, the Chinese are experts at civilizational collapse, societal collapse. They've had six of them, you know, since before Christ, the Chinese have had six societal collapses. So they know what they're talking about. They know better than anybody that this can't last, that nothing lasts forever. And so of course, the last one was the Qing Dynasty. You know, mm-hmm. in 1911, the Qing Dynasty, the great imperial court of China, finally collapsed in China. And so they understand this. The West doesn't. The West is still probably, you know, Rome 400 A.D., where they think that this is going to go on forever and they can keep exploiting and enslaving the people in their sphere of influence. The difference is, you know, Rome was the sphere of influence was you know, the Mediterranean basin, China, you know, stuck within their, you know, pretty much stuck within their existing borders today for their empires. Although it must be said they did colonize Vietnam from 100 BC to about 900 AD. And, but, you know, they rise and they fall. And I see very, you can just see, but you have to leave. You have to get outside of the Great Western Firewall. You're, as some people call it, you know, the Matrix from the movie by the Wachowski brothers. You have to get outside of that Matrix, outside of that Great Western Firewall to really see it. But once you get over here, you know, and get outside, whether you're in Monterey, Mexico, mm-hmm. or, you know, Beijing, China, it's as clear as day. Mm-hmm. But Westerners are so busy being entertained with movies and, you know, Twitter and, you know, music and MTV and, you know, games and, you know, it's just they're too busy being, you know, basically brainwashed to look. And even if they look, they have to really, really dig below the surface to find it. And that's hard to do, you know, as we both know.
And you write also, you say what you learned, that you cannot wrap your head around the popular notion of China's rise without also recognizing Western colonialism's imperial past and ongoing decline. So, I mean, right before talking about China rising, you know, how does America's decline and imperialism factor into or enable China's rise? How do you see the transition from America, and where do you think America is along the line of this decline?
Well, one of the things that China has done in spades, and they actually have the, you know, the financial clout to do it, is they looked at the Western method of imperial control. And what the West has done brilliantly, especially the British, is whenever they have had to cede control of an area that they couldn't keep, they always implant an anti-China, an anti-India, an anti-Ireland, you know, an anti-Korea, you know, an anti-Vietnam, and they have been doing this, and it's been brilliantly successful, much to the misery and at the cost of millions and millions and millions of lives. You know, Ireland was one of the very first ones. You know, Northern Ireland, you know, the British were able to, you know, hang on to, you know, Northern Ireland, to have, you know, that, you know, to leave that on the you know, the island of Ireland, which is rightfully, you know, Ireland's. And so they've got an anti-Ireland, you know, can't, you know, parked right on, you know, Irish soil. You know, Pakistan, the, you know, the division of India in 1947, you know, the Raj, demonically and deviously, you know, work to split India, so that there would be religious and political disharmony and discord in what was then the crown jewel of the British Empire. You know, South Korea creating, you know, an anti, you know, North Korea. And then, you know, sort of, you know, China, Taiwan, 1949, which was fostered and protected and promoted and by the United States, you know, and that's a huge anti-China. And then, of course, the mother of all of them is, you know, the anti-Muslim, you know, the anti-Middle East, you know, Israel, you know, which started in 1917 and culminated in the creation, in my opinion, the legal creation of Israel in 1948, and you can see the horrific effects of the existence of Israel on the Middle East today. And it just you know, Japan, you know, Vietnam, 1950 to 1975, you know, South Vietnam, and to poison the wells. This all goes back to the days of the Greeks and et cetera, where if they were going to lose a territory, you know, they would chop up a bunch of bodies and dead animals and dump them in all the wells, you know, so that they would poison the wells so that they, that, so that when they, that when they left, well, at least they're not going to get to, you know, use what, you know, we had to give up. And this is exactly what the West has been doing. And now for, you know, 500 years. And so the Chinese are pretty observant people. And instead of you know chopping up bodies and creating, you know, hegemonic, you know, poxes on other countries, what China has done is it's doing it legally. And so it has set up the, you know, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I mean, I have a whole in China Rising, I have a whole list of 2 pages of what I call China's anti-West tools. And they, and so instead of going out and creating Northern Ireland's and Israel's, what China is doing is they're using the existing international infrastructure, the financial, political infrastructure to attack the West. And they're doing it in spades. And they're developing their own SWIFT bank system, they're internationalizing the RMB, you know, the Silk Road, the economics, BRICS, the New Development Bank, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. I mean, it just goes on and on. They're creating their own credit agency because they know that Fitch and Moody's and S&P are completely under the control of the Western banks. Now they're coming out, you know, they're the Shanghai Gold Exchange, the Nicaragua Canal, you know, to go to challenge the Panama Canal. It's just the list goes. Did you know that now the second most widely used bank card in the world is Chinese? That the UnionPay has now surpassed MasterCard.
I didn't know that.
And in a couple of years will surpass Visa as the most widely used bank card in the world. When we travel now, we don't even use Western bank cards. We can use our UnionPay everywhere we go. You can even use UnionPay at Walmart in the United States. Not that I always shop there. So this is what China is doing. They're saying, we have the clout and we have the money and we have the long range of the communist mentality of 5-year plans, rolling 10-year plans. And they are, you know, going out to 2050 with their Chinese dream. And they, of course, they don't say this publicly, but they, you know, they are doing everything that they can to undermine the, you know, the Bretton Woods, financial hegemony across the world. And most importantly, is they are teaming up with Russia. And this is so underplayed in the West because the West is absolutely mortified at the thought that the largest, one of the richest countries in the world, Russia, you know, with 1,000-year civilization, and China, you know, a continent-sized country, you know, that's as big as the United States and Canada, and is now the number one GDP country and purchasing power parity, mm-hmm. largest trading company. I mean, it's just, you know, largest, you know, foreign exchange reserves. I mean, you know, number one in just about every category in the world. The West is absolutely mortified, you know, that now Russia and China are literally combining their DNA and working, you know, just locked arms. You know, partnering together with the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, with the Eurasian Economic Union, and you know, you will see the Russia's you know, CSTO, their equivalent of NATO, you know, combining with the SCO, and you know, with BRICS, you know, the R in BRICS is Russia, Brazil, India, South Africa, and China. And so this is the reality. And although I would, maybe you and I would both like for American empire to fall tomorrow. One thing I, learned, in my reading and research, it doesn't happen overnight. Mm-hmm. And although I think it may be, more accelerated thanks to China and Russia's leadership, in the anti-West, what I just call the anti-West, in my writing, it may happen in my lifetime, but Erica, I may be 80 if I live that long. I may be 85 years old, still writing about my hopes for a better world. But the United States may and NATO and what I call Euranglo-land may still be terrorizing and exterminating people all across the planet. It takes decades for an empire to fall.
We were talking about that today in the class about China and revolutions and this transition of empires. And I found it interesting when students asked me, if America loses its influence and China rises, how would that affect us in Mexico? And I thought it was interesting that it would be actually a benefit even for me as an American living in Mexico, because the drug, as you mentioned, the British were running the drugs to China in the Opium War. That's part of the blood of empire, drug traffic. And
of course.
And
well, it hasn't changed now. Heroin, the CIA and heroin in Afghanistan and
right.
The Golden Triangle and uh-huh. cocaine in Colombia and in Central America. I mean, that's all U.S. government.
Right.
That's the CIA. They're running that. I mean, that's their business.
Right. And so
that's their black budget.
And they ask, so the same thing. The American empire is the source of the drug problems that we are experiencing here in Mexico. So then if you just think about it, if the American empire loses some of its economy and power, that would actually be beneficial to us in Mexico, because we'll have less problems with the drug trafficking. And China traditionally doesn't interfere with other countries. And so it would actually be a good thing for Mexico, although the negative part would be the economic aspect. I don't know your thoughts there.
Well, when the dollar as the world's reserve and trade currency, slowly slips. I mean, this is what happened, to Britain, after the Boer War. I mean, that was the beginning of the downfall of the British Empire, was the Boer War. It literally bankrupted the Exchequer in London, and then of course World War One and World War Two just finished them off, and so Britain basically went into a huge decline, and then the United States, in fact, in China Rising, I even have a chapter on the history of currencies going back to the Dutch florin. The Italian florin, going back into the 1400s, and they all last about a couple hundred years, and the reserve currency, and then they finally decline. And but now with the when the Italian florin collapsed, whatever year it was, the 1600s or whatever. It was felt in Italy and maybe in their surrounding trading partners, but now with the intense integration and the horrific globalization that has brought the world's environmental standards to its knees. With that global integration, when it happens with the U.S. dollar, there's going to be a lot of misery around the world. But it's a pain that's going to have to be accepted, and because the benefits, the upside is so great on the other side that it's going to have to be worth it. It's going to be kind of like we're going to go into a worldwide recession / depression, but hopefully 5, 10, 15 years later. With a new world, with a new world leadership of China, Russia, BRICS, the ALBA, in South America, you know, CELAC in South America, et cetera, that, you know, we will finally have some, you know, some peace and harmony on planet Earth, which we have had little or none of since Western Empire started in 1492.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny, in the 90s, the Wolfowitz Doctrine folks, you know, the neocons, they had what they call the Project for a New American Century, which seems to be failing. And then I guess we're talking about the Project for a New Chinese Century, you know, the New Silk Road. And what you were talking
let's call it multipolar for a new multipolar century,
a new Eurasian century.
There you go.
And so what you mentioned, though, is interesting, and maybe you can tell us about from your personal experiences on the street. When I have Americans visit us here in Mexico, I ask them all, what's the situation economically in the States? And everyone hands down tells me, you know, cost of living is up, the taxes, inflation, that, you know, forget it. You know, the middle class is gone. And then now I have a Chinese coworker, and I asked them right before our talk right now, and they were telling me something interesting. They have a son that they've been living here in Mexico, but they had a son who a few years ago did not like the idea of going back to China and living in China, and they thought very poorly of it. And now this son, they tell me, just returned from Shanghai. And they want to go back, the young man, and he's saying, they're describing the situation in China as colorful, thriving, and the way that they were describing it to me sounded like America in the 1800s when the Germans and the Irish and the Italians were all going to America, and it was this happening place to be. So on one hand, I'm getting a feeler from the States that it's not so good, and then on the other hand, I'm hearing all this news about China, like, thriving. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, your Chinese friend is absolutely right. They're, you know, the sorry, Washington, but Beijing is where it's at. I mean, this is the most powerful city in the world, and the Chinese Communist Party is the most powerful political entity in the world. I mean, it is the tail wagging, you know, the Western dog. And it's really, you know, I mean, it's been true since 1949. I mean, every American policy has been dictated, you know, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, Tibet, you know, Xinjiang, Taiwan, I mean, everything, Japan, you know, the tens of thousands of troops, you know, all up and down, you know, the Pacific, you know, theater, all of this is, you know, the great Russian, the great Soviet Chinese split, this has all been to contain China. And so, China is the West's obsession, and it's pathological. It's pathological, and it's cost American and European taxpayers billions upon billions upon billions of dollars, thousands of lives, of, you know, tens of thousands of, well, if you want to count the Vietnam War, millions of lives, even the Korean War, millions of locals died. And so, and now, in spite of all of that, the Chinese, you know, the Communist Party of China is still in power, stronger than ever, managing the world's biggest economy. And this is a happening place, you know. And what you just said is very instructive. We came over here in 2010, our older daughter had just graduated from high school, and we're very happy for her. She just got married a year and a half ago, and she's in the United States and getting a master's in social work, which is very un-American these days. And so she's doing very well back there. But we had our younger daughter who came over here with us, and she was in the ninth grade, and she just graduated this last spring. And she had offers, you know, soccer scholarships all over the United States. She doesn't want to leave. I mean, she's going to school here. And she said, this is my home. This is my, you know, she's learning. She speaks fluent Chinese now and reads and writes fluent Chinese. She doesn't want to leave. She's going to get her degree here. And And you know, you just, there is a buzz and there, what I call white noise. There's just this white noise everywhere you go in China. Just this feeling that, you know, that things are moving. And what your friend said is absolutely, you know, anecdotal. Poll after poll, not Chinese polls. We're talking Gallup and Pew, you know, Western polls show that Chinese are the happiest, most optimistic people in the world. 85% of the Chinese people are looking forward to the future. The Chinese Communist Party has an 85% approval rating because they are bringing home the bacon. They are, incomes are going up. People are buying houses. This is the largest middle class now in the world, over 300 million. They're adding 10,000 people to the middle class every day. The Chinese are now the number one outbound tourist country in the world. It's expanding in double digits. They're flying all over the world. They're going everywhere. And all those students now, a lot of them, you know, that went to the United States, they're starting to come back because this is the new El Dorado of the 21st century. And the difference is, Ariove, is that instead of those Germans and Irish, you know, going out and slaughtering Indians, and later actually Chinese with the Indian Removal Act, where there was actually an ethnic genocide of Chinese in the late 1800s. Instead of those white, you know, racist Europeans slaughtering everything in their sight, you know, to create that optimism and to create that, you know, it's easy to feel, you know, prosperous when you steal everything for nothing, and the Chinese are doing it, and they're not having to exterminate, millions of people and commit genocide on entire civilizations. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. So they're doing it right. They're doing it honestly. The West likes to trump up, oh, the Chinese are colonizing Africa. Well, you go to Africa and you talk to the Africans. Would you rather work with the United States or Europe? Or would you rather work with China? And 95% of the time, they want to work with the Chinese because the Chinese actually are trying to help them. Of course, they want to make money, but they are much more inclined to make it a win-win situation, building hospitals, roads, you know, dams, electrical, you know, power plants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, railroads, ports, infrastructure to help the people over there. And yes, they're going to buy their iron ore and their diamonds or whatever, their bauxite or, you know, their lumber. But at the same time, they are actually trying to help the Africans and the South Americans to better their lives, which the Western Empire never did. It was always just, you know, plunder, pillage, rape, and extraction and exploitation. There was no give. It was all take.
And what does or what would the world have to fear from a potential Chinese empire, do you think?
Nothing, because the Chinese do not have, it's not in their DNA. It is literally not in their DNA. You know, of course, Mao was a fiery revolutionary. You know, he and Lenin, you know, were the sort of at the apex. You can throw in venerable, you know, Fidel Castro. You know, these, you know, Che Guevara, these guys were, you know, revolutionaries first, and they changed the world. And you know, Mao, you know, although the Chinese didn't do nearly as much as the Soviets did in trying to spread communism around the world. You know, Mao talked about it a lot. But other than that, I mean, he is an historical anomaly. Other than colonizing Vietnam from 100 BC to 900 AD, which the Chinese now truly regret because now the Vietnamese hate it. And in the tributary system, you know, for millennia, you know, China was the most powerful country in the region. And as long as the Koreas and the Vietnams and the Japans and the and the Mongols, et cetera, as long as they pay tribute to the Chinese throne, the emperor, there was peace and harmony, and people talked, they want to criticize the tributary system. Well, how many wars have happened over here? Not many, really. I mean, when you compare it to what's happened in the West, the 30-year war, the 100-year war, the War of the Roses, it's just nonstop slaughter. World War One, World War Two. And so the Chinese, there was a famous explorer back in the 75 to 90 years before Christopher Columbus, mistakenly thought he was in India. Zheng He, he was a great sailor for the Chinese, made numerous trips into Indonesia, India, the coast of Africa, the coast of Arabia, with boats that dwarfed the Santa Maria. I mean, these boats were as big, they were like the Titanics of their day. They could hold 1,000 people. He had armadas. The Chinese had, gunpowder. The Chinese, they were so advanced. And instead of taking that gunpowder, which ironically the West turned around and used on the Chinese to destroy and bankrupt China, Chinese, what did they do when they got to Indonesia and India and Arabia and Africa? They wanted to trade. Mm-hmm. They wanted, what do you have? Here's what we've got. Let's do a deal. Let's trade. And the West, your students, your family, Americans have nothing to fear because China, assiduously avoids, getting involved in other countries, internal affairs. And they really, this goes back to the Bandung Conference in 1955, and it is something in Indonesia, and it is something that that's why, countries in Venezuela and all, Argentina, all over, Mexico, they love working with China because they don't have to worry about the CIA and the National Security Council and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and CENTCOM and, AFRICOM and, Obama's secret armies, coming in and infiltrating. I don't have to worry about the drug trade being promoted. So my answer is nothing. In fact, we should, the world would be a much better place. If when the world starts to finally run out of resources, I don't know what would happen then, but I think I would much rather have, China trying to share the world's declining resources than to have, Washington, London, Paris, and Frankfurt, trying to divide it up, because then it would just be an absolute slaughter.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to mention anything about your upcoming publications.
My website is www.chinarising.puntopress.com. I have close to 100 articles on there that are not in my upcoming book called China Rising, Capitalist Roads, Socialist Destinations. And then that should be coming out on Punto Press, hopefully in the next couple of months. And then I have a special project and I'm working on furiously. I'm going to try to get it finished by the end of Chinese New Year, which is basically the middle of February. At least get it sent off to the editor for Badak Mira, Andrei Vlechek's group. That's called China is Communist, Damn It, to overcome all these, shibboleths and propaganda that China has turned into some, neoliberal, capitalist, Ayn Randian, jungle, which is so far from the truth. It's just hilarious. So I'm writing that, and that has kind of put off my other project. And that is Red Letters, the Diaries of Xi Jinping. I'm doing my first fiction and historical fiction. And I've been doing hundreds and basically thousands of hours of research into Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping, who I have tremendous respect and admiration for as a national and world leader. And I'm basically going to start from his, actually before his birth, going back to his parents and his birth, all the way up to the present. You know, why, you know, like, you know, what would he say, you know, in his diaries, if, you know, when this happened today? And I'm having a lot of fun with that, and that should be out hopefully by Christmas of this year.
Okay, well,
and then I'm also, and then I also, you know, do interviews and continue to write. I write for the Greenville Post, dispatch from Beijing, and then I write for the Saker. This is all on my website with links, and that's called the Moscow Beijing Express. I write an article there about once a month. So I'm a busy guy. I also teach Chinese kids full time. So I'm a busy guy.
Well,
but you are too. You're a teacher too, and you also stay busy with this with your journalism.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the time. And you know,
well, thank you. I really enjoyed this.